If someone just collapses in front of you right now, your biggest enemy actually isn't their injury.
Oh, absolutely not. It's your own brain.
Right, it's your brain. The human instinct, which is totally hardwired into us, is usually to just freeze or like
Or
panic.
look around waiting for someone else to step up. Yeah, the bystander effect.
Exactly. The bystander effect completely takes over. But what if you could hack that panic response? What if instead of chaos, you had a forced neurological reset?
Like a clear mental blueprint of exactly what to do next.
Yeah. And that's our mission for you today. We are doing a deep dive into the core principles of emergency response.
Which is so crucial.
It really is. And we're using the Vital Link Student Manual as our guide today.
Yeah, and for those who don't know, this manual is a foundational text for basic and intermediate first aid and CPR. It meticulously follows Canadian guidelines.
Right. And we are going to extract the mechanisms of emergency care so that you understand not just, what to do, but why you were doing it.
Because having that structured approach completely rewires the dynamic of the room. I mean, you transition from being a helpless bystander to functioning as a vital link in the chain of survival.
And that shift in mindset doesn't come from having a medical degree, right?
No. It comes from having a reliable framework to fall back on when your adrenaline spikes.
So we'll navigate the critical legal protections in Ontario that actually empower you to step forward. We'll break down the physiology of immediate trauma, and we'll walk through the overarching four steps of emergency scene management.
The overarching goal here is basically threefold, right? Preserve life, prevent injuries from worsening, and promote recovery.
Preserve, prevent, promote. I like that.
Yeah. And achieving those goals actually starts long before you ever lay hands on a patient. It begins with addressing the psychological barriers that stop people from helping in the first place.
Oh, totally. I mean, before I even think about touching a patient, my brain is screaming about liability.
Oh, for sure. Getting sued.
Right. I hear this fear constantly. People are terrified they'll do CPR incorrectly, break a rib, and just get sued into bankruptcy by the person they are trying to save.
It's a huge hurdle. And the manual tackles that fear immediately because, frankly, hesitation costs lives.
So how does the law actually handle that?
Well, in Ontario, you are shielded by the Good Samaritan Act of 2001.
Okay.
This legislation is specifically engineered to protect individuals who voluntarily provide emergency first aid at the scene of an accident or illness.
Voluntary being the key word there, I assume.
Exactly. The law dictates that you are protected from liability for damages. You literally cannot be sued for negligence in your actions or even your failures to act while providing emergency services.
Wait, really? But the implication there has to be that I need to be acting within reason,
Oh,
right?
absolutely.
Like, if I have basic first aid training, I shouldn't be attempting to perform, I don't know, an emergency tracheotomy with a ballpoint pen.
No, please don't do that.
Right, so there has to be a line where the protection ends.
Yeah, the legal boundary is defined as gross negligence.
Gross negligence.
Right. You are protected as long as you act in good faith and, crucially, within the scope of your training. If you're doing your level best, following the basic framework you've learned to preserve life, the legal system provides a safety net.
Because the entire premise of the law is to encourage action over inaction.
Exactly. But there is another layer to this legal protection that reflects a massive shift in public policy, especially recently.
Are you talking about the overdose stuff?
Yeah, the manual specifically highlights the Good Samaritan Drug Overdose Act from 2017.
Right, because if we look at the opioid crisis, you have bystanders who might have, illegal substances in their own pockets.
Yep.
And their friend overdoses, and they face this agonizing choice, like call 911 to save their friend and risk getting arrested themselves, or flee.
And that hesitation was proving fatal over and over again. So the 2017 Act steps in to provide legal immunity against simple drug possession charges.
Just simple possession.
Right, or breaches of probation related to simple possession, specifically for the person who calls emergency services during an overdose.
Oh, wow. So the state is making a definitive calculation there.
They are. They're saying preserving a human life completely supersedes a minor drug infraction. They're stripping away the fear of legal repercussions to ensure people actually make the call.
That makes total sense. But even with those robust legal shields in place, we still have to navigate the patient's rights, don't we?
Oh, absolutely. Consent is non-negotiable.
Right. I mean, I can't just sprint up to someone who tricked, tackle them to the ground, and start bandaging their knee.
No, you definitely cannot do that. The manual places a strict mandate on consent. For first aid purposes, if you have an adult, which is defined as someone 16 or older, who is conscious and rationally thinking, you must secure verbal consent.
So I just walk up and say, "Hi, I know first aid. Can I help?
Precisely. You approach, identify yourself as a trained first aider, and explicitly ask if you can help.
And if they say no?
If they refuse, you maintain your distance. You can monitor them, you can absolutely call paramedics, but you cannot force your assistance upon them.
Okay, navigating that is straightforward when they can talk to you. But the legal gray area seems to be when, say, someone just hits the floor in the coffee shop line and they are completely unresponsive.
Right, they can't say yes.
Exactly. What do you do then?
Well, the law bridges that gap with the doctrine of implied consent.
Implied consent.
Yeah. The underlying legal assumption is that if a person were conscious, rational, and aware that their life was in immediate danger, they would actively request life-saving intervention.
So their consent to be saved is legally implied by the fact that they're unresponsive.
You got it.
I always picture implied consent like a computer's emergency safety protocol.
Okay, how so?
Well, if the operating system completely crashes, representing the patient going unconscious, the default hardwired setting of the machine is to preserve the core hardware at all costs.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, the system doesn't wait for a user prompt, right? It just automatically triggers the emergency backup. So implied consent is basically society's version of that default safety protocol.
That is a perfect analogy. The default is always preservation. But there's a catch.
What's the catch?
Once you trigger that protocol and step into the role of rescuer, you inherit a legal obligation. You cannot abandon the patient.
Wait, abandonment?
Yes. Once you initiate care, you are legally bound to continue assisting to the best of your physical abilities until you are relieved by someone with equal or higher medical training.
Like paramedics.
Exactly. You can't perform CPR for 2 minutes, decide you're bored or tired, and just walk away.
Okay, let me test the limits of that abandonment rule, though.
Go for it.
Say I am helping someone who collapsed in an aisle, and suddenly the building's fire alarm triggers, and I look up and see thick smoke billowing from the ceiling.
Okay.
My instinct for self-preservation kicks in. If I evacuate to save myself, the abandonment rule makes it sound like I am committing a crime by leaving them there.
Okay. No. The absolute golden rule of emergency response, and this supersedes every other law and guideline, is that rescuer safety comes first.
Rescuer safety?
Always. You are totally useless to the patient if you become a casualty yourself.
Right, then the paramedics have two patients instead of one.
Exactly. Evacuating a burning building is not abandonment. It is basic survival. And that stark reality brings us to the very first physical action you must take in any emergency.
Which is designed to prevent you from becoming that second victim.
Yes. Step one of the emergency scene management framework. The scene survey.
The scene survey. This is where we hack that panic response we talked about earlier.
Right, because the human instinct is to develop tunnel vision and sprint directly to the person screaming on the floor.
But the scene survey forces a hard pause.
You have to force yourself to stop and scan the environment. You ask yourself, do I see, smell, or hear anything that might harm me?
So you are aggressively hunting for hazards before you even step into the zone.
Aggressively. Are there spilled chemicals? Are there live electrical wires? Is there high-speed traffic? Or maybe an aggressive animal nearby?
And if there is? If the environment is fundamentally unsafe?
You do not approach. You retreat to a safe distance and activate emergency services.
Okay, so assuming the scene doesn't immediately threaten my life, I'm still actively scanning as I walk toward the patient, right?
Yes.
Because the manual emphasizes identifying the MOI, the mechanism of injury.
Right.
This is essentially analyzing the kinetics of trauma. I'm looking at the physical forces involved to deduce what might be broken inside the body before I even touch them.
You are operating as a forensic detective.
Mm.
If you approach a vehicle collision and observe a shattered windshield and a heavily deformed steering wheel,
physics dictates what happened to the human body inside.
Exactly. The kinetics tell you the occupant's head struck the glass and their chest impacted the wheel. You can anticipate severe head, neck, and internal chest injuries.
Which dictates how carefully you will need to handle their cervical spine.
Spot on. And while your brain is processing the physics of the scene, your hand should be preparing the physical barriers.
Personal protective equipment, PPE.
Yep. The manual mandates the use of non-latex examination gloves to isolate the rescuer from bloodborne pathogens.
Right. So once the gloves are on and I am kneeling beside the patient, I need to diagnose their neurological state, and the manual uses the AVPU scale.
Yes, AVPU. It's an acronym measuring the brain's responsiveness.
Let's break that down.
Sure. So A stands for alert, meaning their eyes are open, they're visually tracking your movement, and the brain is actively processing the environment.
Okay, that's the best case scenario.
Right. Then V is for verbal. This indicates a decreased state of consciousness. They might be slumped over, but if you speak loudly or shout their name, their brain registers the auditory input.
So they might groan or flutter their eyes?
Exactly.
Now, the P in AVP is where I really have to pause.
Okay, why is that?
The manual instructs me to use pain as the next stimulus. I mean, I am intentionally inflicting physical discomfort on someone who has just suffered a massive trauma. That feels deeply counterproductive to the whole prevent further harm thing.
I get that. The terminology can sound aggressive, but the mechanism is purely diagnostic. You are not trying to cause suffering.
So what am I actually doing?
Well, if the brain fails to respond to auditory input, the verbal stage, you need to test the central nervous system's hardwired survival reflexes. You apply a minor localized pinch.
Where?
Typically to the back of the upper arm or the collarbone. You are just looking for a biological withdrawal reflex.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, if the brain is still functioning at a basic neurological level, it will perceive that stimulus and instinctively command the muscles to pull away from it.
Okay, so it's a primitive circuit test.
Exactly.
And if I apply that pinch and there is absolutely no flinch, no withdrawal, no sound, they fall into the U category.
Unresponsive.
Unresponsive. The brain is effectively offline.
And an unresponsive patient instantly escalates the severity of the situation. It forces an immediate transition from analyzing the external environment to analyzing the patient's internal biology.
Which brings us to step two.
Yes. Step two, the primary survey.
The primary survey is basically a rapid hunt for immediate life-ending threats.
We are focusing entirely on the ABCs. Airway, breathing, and circulation.
Because if any component of that system fails, the biological clock drops to just minutes before brain death occurs.
Right. So let's look at the mechanics of the airway. If a patient is unconscious and lying flat on their back, their own anatomy actually becomes a lethal weapon.
Wait, how so?
When the brain goes offline, the body loses all muscle tone. The tongue is a massive muscle, and without that tone, gravity pulls it directly backward into the throat.
Oh, physically sealing off the trachea.
Exactly. So you have to mechanically bypass that blockage using the head tilt chin lift technique.
Okay, how do we do that?
By placing one hand on the forehead and two fingers under the bony part of the jaw, you gently rotate the head backward. This physical pivot stretches the tissues of the neck, which physically pulls the tongue forward and away from the back of the airway.
So simple, but life-saving.
Yeah. And once that anatomical roadblock is cleared, you position your ear near their mouth to look, listen, and feel for the mechanical process of breathing.
And if the chest isn't rising and falling normally,
then we are instantly looking at initiating CPR. But while assessing circulation, the manual stresses performing a rapid visual sweep of the entire body to hunt for major bleeding.
Right, because the cardiovascular system is essentially a closed loop of plumbing.
A great way to think about it.
Yeah, if there's a massive arterial bleed, doing CPR to pump the heart is totally futile because you're just pumping the remaining blood out onto the floor.
Exactly. You must plug the hole. Major bleeding requires immediate, aggressive, direct pressure to compress the break in blood vessels against the underlying bone.
Giving the blood a chance to clot.
Right. Now, diagnosing what is going wrong with this biological plumbing requires a very specific vocabulary. The manual enforces a rigid distinction between a sign and a symptom.
Right. And this isn't just semantics. It dictates how we gather intelligence on the scene.
Absolutely. The distinction separates objective reality from subjective experience.
Okay, break that down for me.
So a sign is empirical data. It's a physical manifestation that you, the rescuer, can objectively see, hear, or smell.
Like seeing arterial blood spurting.
Right. Or hearing a high-pitched wheezing sound from their lungs. Or smelling a distinct fruity odor on their breath, which is a classic chemical marker of a diabetic emergency.
Okay, so signs are objective, but a symptom is entirely subjective.
Yes.
It's the internal sensation that the patient must verbally communicate to you. Like if they tell you, my chest feels like there is an anvil sitting on it, or I feel incredibly nauseous.
Or my left arm is tingling.
Oh!
You cannot see nausea. You cannot hear tingling. You rely entirely on the patient's reporting for symptoms.
It is exactly like troubleshooting a failing car with a mechanic.
Oh, here we go. Let's hear the car analogy.
Okay, so the symptom is you walking into the garage and complaining, hey, the car feels incredibly sluggish when I try to merge onto the highway and it shudders.
Right, that is subjective. The mechanic cannot verify the sluggishness while it's just parked in the bay.
Exactly. But the sign is the mechanic popping the hood and visually confirming a snapped serpentine weld or smelling burning oil. The mechanic independently verifies the sign.
That's spot on. In a medical emergency, combining the subjective symptoms with the objective signs gives you the complete diagnostic picture.
And gathering that complete diagnostic picture is what transitions us into step three.
The secondary survey.
Right. So by the time you reach this step, you've manually opened the airway, confirmed they are breathing, and clamped down on any catastrophic bleeding.
The initial frantic fight against the biological clock is momentarily paused. The patient is stabilized for now.
So your psychological role shifts from immediate lifesaver to field investigator.
Because the paramedics are en route, but they are flying blind. Your job is to gather all the perishable evidence before it disappears.
Perishable evidence. Meaning, if the patient's condition deteriorates and they lose consciousness in 3 minutes, the answers they give you right now are the only clues the hospital will have.
Exactly. And the tool we use to systematically collect this evidence is the sample interview, S-A-M-P-L-E.
Okay, let's run through that acronym.
Sure. So S stands for the signs and symptoms we just discussed. A investigates allergies. Are they severely allergic to penicillin, or do they just get stung by a bee, which could trigger an anaphylactic cascade?
Vital to know. M is for medications, I assume.
Right. You need to know if they're taking blood thinners, which would explain why a minor cut won't stop bleeding, or if they have a prescribed inhaler in their pocket.
Okay, what's P?
P explores past medical history. A sudden collapse means something very different if they have a history of severe cardiac arrest versus a history of epilepsy.
That makes sense. L focuses on their last meal or drink, right? Which seems trivial, but if their injuries require emergency surgery, the anesthesiologist desperately needs to know if their stomach is full of food.
Right, because that poses a massive risk of vomiting and choking while sedated.
Good point. And finally, E.
E reconstructs the events leading up to the incident. You want to know the sequence?
Like, did they grab their chest in pain and then fall down a flight of stairs? Or did they trip on a rug, fall down the stairs, and then fracture their ribs?
Exactly. The sequence changes the entire medical approach.
So while I am conducting this interview and preserving this history, the manual instructs me to record their vital signs, level of consciousness, breathing rate, and pulse quality every 5 minutes.
Yes, every 5 minutes.
But taking the pulse once tells me their heart is beating right now. Why do I need to keep remeasuring it like clockwork?
Because a single measurement is just a static snapshot.
Oh.
It tells you absolutely nothing about the trajectory of their internal systems.
Oh, okay.
By taking vitals every 5 minutes, you are mapping a trend. If their pulse is 80 beats per minute, then 100, then 130.
You've just documented that their cardiovascular system is rapidly compensating for a hidden crisis.
Bingo. That trend line is the most valuable intelligence you can hand over to the arriving paramedics.
So mapping that trajectory naturally dictates how you manage the patient while waiting for the ambulance, which brings us to step four.
Ongoing patient care.
Right. You are monitoring vitals, offering reassurance, and the manual specifically mandates that you treat for shock.
Yes, treating for shock is critical.
But here is where my logic hits a wall.
Okay, hit me.
If a coworker trips, sustains a relatively minor laceration to their arm, is sitting up, talking perfectly normally, and appears entirely fine, treating them for shock feels like a dramatic overreaction to a minor event.
I get why you'd think that. It feels like an overreaction because the general public equates shock with being emotionally startled. Like, oh, I was shocked when I heard the news.
Right.
But in emergency medicine, shock is a lethal systemic mechanical failure. It means the body's tissues and vital organs are no longer receiving adequate oxygenated blood flow.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you can have hypovolemic shock, where massive bleeding means the hydraulic fluid in the system is simply gone. You can have cardiogenic shock, where the heart muscle itself is damaged and the pump fails.
Or anaphylactic shock, right?
Exactly, where an allergic reaction causes the blood vessels to massively dilate, dropping blood pressure to near zero.
So it's literally a catastrophic failure of the body's hydraulic system.
Precisely. And the manual teaches a vital physiological truth. The cascade of shock begins at the precise moment of injury.
Wait, really? The exact moment?
Yes. The body instantly recognizes a threat and begins aggressively defending the core. It forcefully constricts the blood vessels in the arms, legs, and skin, shunting all available blood to the brain, heart, and lungs.
Okay, so it prioritizes the organs.
Right. But by the time you can visibly see the classic signs of shock, the pale, cold, clammy skin, the rapid, shallow breathing, the confusion, the body's compensatory mechanisms are already failing.
Oh, so if you wait for the physical signs to appear before you start treating it.
The spiral might be irreversible. The treatment must be preemptive.
You're not waiting for the system to crash. You are acting to prevent the crash.
Exactly.
So what does that physical treatment actually look like in the field? I mean, I don't have IV fluids or medications on me.
The treatment is mechanical and environmental. You lay the patient down, utilizing gravity to help blood return from the legs to the heart and brain.
Makes sense.
You cover them with a coat or blanket to preserve body heat. A traumatized body burns massive amounts of oxygen and energy just trying to shiver and stay warm.
So keep them warm, lay them down.
Yeah. You also offer psychological reassurance to lower their heart rate and reduce the oxygen demand on their system.
Right, keep them calm.
And most importantly, you deny them any food or water.
Even if they are begging for a drink.
Even then. Ensuring their stomach remains empty is crucial in case their digestive system shuts down or they require immediate surgery.
Wow. Implementing these preemptive measures does absolutely zero harm to a stable person, but it gives a deteriorating patient a fighting chance. Mm-hmm. When you step back and look at this entire structure, the brilliance of the manual becomes clear. From leveraging the Good Samaritan Act to silence your legal fears,
to utilizing the scene survey as a forced neurological reset,
executing the primary survey to patch the biological plumbing, and performing the secondary survey to gather vital intelligence. It is a continuous logical algorithm.
It really is. It strips away the overwhelming chaos of an emergency and replaces it with manageable sequential actions.
You don't need to be a doctor to save a life. You just need the discipline to run the algorithm until the professionals take over.
Absolutely. The algorithm is designed to protect the patient, but there is one incredibly profound point in the manual aimed directly at protecting the rescuer.
Protecting the rescuer.
Yeah. We dedicate intense focus to training our hands to perform chest compressions and training our minds to memorize acronyms. But tucked into the guidelines is a section on occupational stress injury and self-care.
You know, we focus so heavily on the physical survival of the patient, we completely ignore the psychological aftermath for the person who stepped up to help.
Think about the physiological toll. You have just experienced a massive dump of adrenaline and cortisol. You forced your brain to override its natural instincts, managing a chaotic high-stakes trauma.
Right.
But once the paramedics load that patient into the ambulance and the flashing lights fade down the street, you are just left standing on the sidewalk.
The emergency is over for the patient, but the biochemical storm is still raging inside you.
That is a crucial realization for anyone stepping into the role of a workplace or community first aider. You successfully execute the blueprint, you held the line, but that accumulated stress does not just magically evaporate when the ambulance doors close.
So recognizing that psychological impact and knowing that it is normal to need time to process that adrenaline and trauma is vital.
You cannot be a resilient link in the chain of survival if you don't eventually care for the mind that managed the crisis. Self-care is basically the unwritten fifth step of emergency management.
That is incredibly profound. So the next time you're standing in line at the coffee shop and the unthinkable happens, you know you aren't a helpless bystander. The law has your back. You have the algorithm. You scan the scene, secure the airway, plug the leaks, and gather the data.
You have the power to override the panic.
You absolutely do. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. Take care of each other out there.